Welcome to another podcast from Vermont's Last Theater in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Alex Hancock, and I'm pleased indeed to be introducing Andrea Potas, one of the treasures of our poetry scene here in Madison. Andrea has published several books of poetry, including Arrows of Light, If We Lit the Lamps Ourselves, Abundance to Share with the Birds, Yaya's Cloth, The Perfect Day, and very recently, A Stone to Carry Home, her new one, which is just out from Salmon Poetry. Welcome, Andrea. And I was thinking about how when you were doing your reading in Spring Green recently, you opened with the poem called Midlife Late, and you described it as possibly depressing. I actually found it sort of terrifying, but I hope that doesn't put anybody off because I think it's a wonderful poem.
Well, so it's you know, one of those times when you feel a bit, not pessimistic necessarily, but portentous, you know, and we all have moments like that. So shall I read it? Midlife Late. Some days you can feel your body bracing, pressed against the door, as if to fend off those losses to come. They wait in line, possess such patience, a calm you could learn if you tried. They know time belongs to them after all. Through the keyhole of the hours, their shapes carve shadows on your floor.
In the next poem in the book, you talk about, well, you quote one of your favorites, John Keats, with the words, trying the resources of his spirit. I think a lot of poems in this book deal with adversity and dealing with it and needing to call upon the resources of one's own spirit.
You know, that's probably true. Yeah, because there are some hard things that present themselves, as in, shall I read the second? Morning of my 56th birthday. And in this poem, there's a snippet from John Keats's letters, and I think you'll know what part that is. The lake is a blue scarf ironed by stillness, locust leaves burnt yellow, everywhere softness in September air. Spread on my table, a book of Keats's letters. The first thing that strikes me on hearing a misfortune having befallen another is, well, it cannot be helped. He will have the pleasure of trying the resources of his spirit. While miles away at this moment, my mother meets with the doctor. He will aim one perfect arrow of light in that errant spot that would claim her if it had its way, my mother, from whose body I came. I realize in both those poems I'm talking about these potential losses as having like a life of their own almost, like they're out to get you. That's a very Greek thing, I should tell you. Oh, it really is, like tragedy, you know, the evil eye, everything, tragedy's right there. And I didn't even know that was in me, but there it is. And then there's that sense of destiny. And I think I should read the one that comes after what I just read, because this speaks of a certain kind of destiny also.
This next one is set in Milwaukee, where you grew up.
Right, yeah.
And it leads us into the theme of going back to Greece, which is one of the main themes of the book and where the title comes from.
Yeah, this is in Milwaukee, and there was an old Byzantine church that was torn down to make room for the beautiful Frank Lloyd Wright Church. In 1961 it was built. But this was the old Byzantine one on the east side. I ask my mother to show me the old Greek church of her childhood. We drive beside Lake Michigan's near unearthly blue. At Knapp and Broadway, she points to the spot, now a parking lot, clean black tar, planted with a zillion tiny stars that glint in the September light. It was there, she said, where she, at 14, first saw my father. I told myself I'm going to marry that boy. I imagine her waiting at the bottom of that small hill. He moved toward her, his white shirt shuddering in the breeze off the water, his face so clear from afar, olive skin and dark hair blazing in air like a young god, the planet spinning from her axis onto his.
Their lives were so different from ours, weren't they?
Yeah. 14. I mean, she was 14. He was 16. couldn't. She knew a moment she saw him. Can't fight destiny of the gods. But here I am.
And from the old Greek church in Milwaukee, we go back to Greece itself. You've traveled to Greece 3 times, yes? And most recently with your daughter, which inspired many of the poems in A Stone to Carry Home. Could you tell us a little bit about that journey?
I sure could. We traveled to my grandfather's village. He came here when he was a teenager. And it's a tiny, tiny village 2 hours north of Delphi, impossible to find on our own. We got a wonderful old friend of the family, distantly related, drove us there. It was twisting and turning, and we could never have found it. It's called Pendayou, and we found remnants of his home there. My grandfather's home, Pendayou, Greece. Tin corrugated and rusted, now covers what was once the roof. A few mossy tiles lie scattered. 3 walls were main. In places, vines sprout across the uneven gray. My daughter and I bend, peer under a muddy tarp that cloaks a rubble of fallen stones, as if saved for the day the granddaughter and the great-granddaughter could cross the Atlantic, drive the dizzying mountain roads to kneel on the April grass and reach their arms inside, pick 1 stone to carry home.
So the granddaughter and the great-granddaughter go back to the old world and find a stone to carry home, and the granddaughter writes this poem in this book. And the picture on the front of the book, I believe, is a picture, the view from your grandfather's old house.
Yes, the picture is something I took from the porch of my grandfather's nephew's home, right by his house. But isn't that something?
Your grandfather's family, now they emigrated from Greece when he was a teenager, is that right?
Yes, can you imagine the immensity of that?
And did they come right to Milwaukee?
Yes, originally they did settle in Milwaukee. Yeah, you know, they have to come through New York, of course, but some of the family went off to San Francisco. My grandfather stayed in Milwaukee, yeah.
Do you think he felt that his family had made the right decision to leave Greece? And
they were told that a better life was here, you know, that's the old cliche, and they were told that, and they wanted to come here. No, he was glad he came. He was glad he came, and he ended up being a restaurateur, you know. He had 3 restaurants in Milwaukee, you know, the old Greek diners, but very nice, some of them, the Cosmopolitan, the Harmony, what was the 3rd one, I forget, but that was his thing, yeah. Well, the one might still be there on North Avenue with another name, but, you know, it's been a long time. Shall I read another Greek poem?
Yeah, if you would read another one of the Greek poems. The boy with the octopus gives us, I think, an unforgettable scene.
Well, it was an amazing moment. We're talking a young boy. This is a boy. We were in Galaxidi, which is a lovely little seaside town on the Gulf of Corinth. And this boy was probably 12 years old. We were just walking by the pier, and here he was. It's called The Boy and the Octopus. A crowd had gathered around him, an octopus in his bare hands, as he kneeled to slap and rub the body against the pier, sliding it onto the stone before dipping it back into the sea, swirling and lifting and beginning again, the grayish, pale creature of limp arms and bulbous flesh. The boy stayed silent as he worked, not once looking up at us looming near him. I had so little Greek, I could not ask for explanation. Though I suspected he was rinsing the body of its poisons and its ink, cleansing to make way for the slicing and the frying, the olive oil, lemon, and thyme, the taverna tables just yards away. And that's the amazing thing. These people are just catching their food and literally bringing it over to the tavernas.
I've had octopus, but I've never had it that fresh.
Yes. Yeah, it was wonderful.
And your daughter loved the journey, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, relished it. She makes the most of, you know, she got the connection that we were making with the ancestors. And, you know, we went and sat in the platea, which is like the village square. And there's a, you know, the restaurant there. And was it my grandfather's niece, niece's daughter's something. I mean, there was a distant relative who waited on us. It was so cool. Yeah.
Another poem from the trip to Greece is simply called It Happens in Greece. And it also it includes the phrase, I think it's the only Greek phrase that you have in any of the poems, Evcharisto, which means thank you.
Thank you, yes. And this was a true story that we had a taxi driver who happened to have been from the same village as my grandfather came from. What's the likelihood of that? Talk about destiny. So he was taking us up to Delphi and he kept stopping along the way to show us things. And this was one of them. It happens in Greece that your taxi driver, Mikas, will make a sudden stop along the twisting road at an unmarked bakery where two stooped ladies greet you with words rushing like a fast-moving creek as they point to an open brick vault filled with flames and risen loaves that turn out to be more than mere bread, scooped out with a long paddle, laid on the wood counter and sliced. Loaves that had secretly been twined with a Greek cheese waking your tongue to heaven and salt before you say Evcharisto, before you leave on your way to the sweep of the oracle's remains. Amazingly delicious bread. I did not expect that cheese in the middle of it.
What is Delphi like now? Is it real touristy?
Well, the town is very touristy, but the remains itself are quite magnificent. You know, and you've got what a panoramic view. I mean, and you know, I mean, they are just ruins now, but the view from there, it's you can really feel the gravity of it, of being there.
Paintings are very important in your poetry as well. It seems that wherever you go on your travels, you make careful note of the paintings you find. Van Gogh's bedroom, for example.
The Art Institute of Chicago had a beautiful exhibit basically recreating Van Gogh's bedroom in Arles? Is that how you pronounce it? You know, the one that he wanted to share with Gauguin and make it like an artist's haven. And they had it was multimedia. I mean, they had music and images flashing on the walls, and it was just very incredible. Van Gogh's bedroom. Forget the filmed theories, the written explications of motives and compositions. Lean against the wall to take in the life-size rooms he longed to share with Gauguin. Place of unshakable repose, a poet's garden. Yellow bed, thatched chair, Vincent's words materializing, dissolving on a wall of pale ochre. Fauré's refrain plays over and over in reverent air. Close your eyes to sink into that color he called pale sulfur yellow, pale golden yellow. How lovely yellow is, he wrote to his brother Theo. Even against pressing darkness, there is a sun.
Van Gogh's letters are so just amazing. I remember when I first read them, I thought, this is unfair that someone who was such a great painter could also have been such a wonderful writer.
Absolutely. Profoundly spiritual and just so wise. So wise. I love his letters.
And you quote the phrase, how lovely yellow is. That's actually one of the phrases that I remember best from Van Gogh's letters. I think about it almost every time I see the color yellow. I also think about something else he said, if something along the lines of, and I'm paraphrasing here, if I were God, I would regard the world as a study that didn't quite turn out right.
Oh.
And there's certainly, he saw many dark things in life, but not only that.
No, he was, well, as he said, I mean, even against pressing darkness, there is a sun. And on some level, I think that's why he appeals to me so much. And even with all his hardship, I mean, one piece of him was always aimed towards the light, you know, in spite of everything. Anyway, he's a beautiful figure.
The sun and gold.
I love gold. And there's lots of that color in here. And it's like my last chapbook, Arrows of Light. That's actually a line taken from one of the poems I just read. There's a lot of gold in that, too. I have a thing for gold.
How about the poem simply called Gold?
Oh, sure. This is for my grandmother. wonderful lady. She was called Yaya. That means grandmother in Greek. Gold. It lined our Yaya's window sills, poured through the glass, bounced off the beveled edges of her cupboards. It streamed through her yard where we played in the tickling grass while she waved to us through her sewing room windows, and we knew it wasn't white the angels wore. Wings filling the air like her laundry flapping on the line, sun penetrating each cotton pore so that later we'd be held by the aftermath of gold on our skin. You know, those moments that you know in childhood were the ultimate moments of heaven. That's that moment, is being in Yaya's backyard. I remember the tickling grass.
And this was in what part of Milwaukee?
Yes, 52nd Street.
52nd and...
North.
Two other painters that seem to inspire you a lot in this book are Monet and Matisse. Would you read one of the poems? One of those poems?
I haven't read Harmony in Red. I will. Henri Matisse is someone I also love. Harmony in Red. My hands find a nest of apples and lemons. Around me, the blue antlers of some unseen creature inscribe the air. I breathe red dipped in orange, red doused in light. A vase of yellow flowers has begun blooming my name. If I choose, beyond the windows, a blue and green happiness would greet me, etched with ice-white trees. There's that yellow again. His paintings have a kind of almost a surreal quality. But yet there's also warmth there that I love.
You know? Yeah, his paintings are, some people think of them as abstract, but
no,
I think they're not. I think they're very...
They're very... Approaching.
Welcoming.
Yeah, welcoming is a good word for them.
Andrea, your poems have appeared in, well, many anthologies, including one called Mothers and Daughters. And I'm wondering now if we could turn to some of the poems in the book that come out of your relationship with your daughter.
Yes. Daughter at 16. Each day is another cutting away from the body of mother, daughter, each stitch released to make room for the girth of her reach. I tell myself this is how it is done, picturing the way she'd sit for hours on her toy room rug, cutting along the dots to free her paper dolls from the background that held them.
Parenting involves so much loss, doesn't it, inevitably? And, of course, dealing with moments of anger that can feel just global.
There's no fighting it. Right, and we need, I suppose we could try and fight it, but why would I want to do that? Yeah.
And then, of course, your daughter is getting ready to go off to college.
Yes, and I think a lot of parents can relate to this with their kid. Who, you know, you have these moments of great tension, and then poof, whatever. In that moment, an anger rose like a stalk of heat. A crimson bloom that was my breath. Then it seeped to pale when she skipped up the front steps, solid explanation in her hands. A bell in my chest rang out. A small rain began to quench us both. You know, by that time, they've forgotten all about it. You've been stewing on it. 'Cause their minds are teeming elsewhere.
And then comes the time of going off to the college that your child has chosen and visiting it with her.
Yes, yes, that was a wonderful thing. Visiting your child's chosen college. Inside you, an acceptance, like time-lapse photography of a meadow blooming. These fields and winding sidewalks, these brick and stone buildings, tall with light, will keep her, will shine upon her. Worry unpeels its wolf skin and lies down. I realize that's quite a leap to go from the meadow blooming to the wolf skin, but maybe not. Maybe wolves go through meadows. Maybe it's not such a leap.
And here, worry is taking off its wolf skin and resting, taking a break.
I think at least worry is taking a rest because it's lying down, because I don't think we'd necessarily stop worrying forever, right? There's always going something that But definitely it lies down. And there's, like I said, the acceptance starts to bloom.
And now she's away for the first time.
Gone, yes. And then, of course, after going to college for the first time, gone. First fall semester. Every day now, the made bed, bathroom floor and carpets, sprawling lands once marked by loose papers and books, unkept markers, the crumpled remains of shirts, loose socks, and Target receipts, all the consoling evidence of inhabitants. The air is unsung with her voice.
Unsung? I don't think there's anything to add to that last line.
Oh, really? Okay. I don't know what it means. It was just there for me, right? I mean, it's not an emptiness. It's something different. I don't know. Then, of course, they come home for vacations, and all those things are back on the floor.
So there she is. She's gone. And then, for the first time, she calls home.
Oh, yes. With the binky? Sure. Okay. So first call home. A fluttering or shimmering in the air, as if filled with threads. Bright as corn silk in September's late light, soft as down of milkweed, seeds in flight, everywhere between you. There's that September light again.
A lot of September in these poems.
Yes, this is a good time to be reading these poems, I think. Shall I read Daughter Home? Daughter Home. I left her sleeping in her original bed, home from the dorm where she lives most of her days away from us now, most of the hours. We could not tell you just what she is doing, whom she might be with, though we may consult the schedule posted on the fridge and say, now she is in her FM lecture, now she left film class, her hours mostly not ours to know, except for this one week of spring vacation, sleeping down the carpeted hallway we once tread to wake her for elementary school, middle school, high school, and eons before that, when we stood over her, smitten, staring at her breathing, her miraculous breathing, watching her dream, a binky in each of her hands.
So here we go back to elementary school, then forward to middle school, high school, and then suddenly we're much further back into her infancy, the eons of infancy.
Then you're going way back. Yeah, yes. It does feel like eons, doesn't it?
Andrea, one aspect of your poetry that is so striking to me is its concision, your ability to take us to a certain place or an emotional state in the fewest possible words. How about if we end with one of the poems where I think that concision is at its most powerful, the one where your daughter is angry and there is nothing else in the world, and then she's back to not angry.
Shall I read that? You know, and of course this is deliberate. I don't need to explain, I guess, but deliberate hyperbole to make the point that I'm making, right? When your child is happy again. The polar ice caps cease their melting. The holes in the atmosphere close in for repair. A thousand new angels stand in line to receive their wings as your stalking heart returns home.
As I said, everything in parenting can be so global. The good times and the bad.
Exactly. And it's very hard not to have it, the whole world, be wrong. Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad I got to write that poem.
Andrea, thank you for being with us today on our podcast.
Well, thank you.
It's a delight to make a connection between you and our listeners and Andrea Potis, ladies and gentlemen.